Welcome to Our Story, Your Story, the video podcast where we share our personal experiences and invite you to share yours. We are Toby Eunice and Shelley Carney, and together we'll take you on a journey through our lives and the lives of our family, friends, and guests. We believe that everyone has a story to tell, and we can all learn from each other's experiences. So whether you're looking for inspiration, entertainment, or simply a good story, you've come to the right place. Hello, and welcome to Our Story, Your Story. I'm Shelley Carney.
And I'm Toby Eunice. Thanks for joining us today.
Today, we're going to be diving into A Gypsy's Kiss, Treasure Hunt Adventure. And we'll be reading a couple of chapters, number 29 and 30. They're both fairly short, but there is a lot of interesting stuff going on in both of them. And if you remember, Mariah and Miguel had just jumped out of the window to escape from Jean-Luc and his switchblade as he was fighting with Mariah's grandfather, Jacques.
Jacques de Noël.
And he had just stabbed Jacques, and they took off out the window and dived off the roof, or rolled off the roof, I guess, and landed into the Mississippi River. So
muddy, smelly Mississippi River.
Muddy and smelly. And so we're going to get into chapter 29, Losing My Boots. An entire movie of thoughts races through my mind in the time it takes me to realize I've jumped into the warm, brown, deep river water. We are floating on the surface of the Mississippi River. The only thing I know about the Mississippi River comes from my reading of Mark Twain's The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. According to Huck, it is muddy and wide with a life of its own and composed of currents and eddies that can suck you into its craw in a matter of seconds. It is not a forgiving river. Mariah instructs in a loud whisper, "Take off your boots." "What?" I ask. She kicks me in the shin with her bare foot. "Take off your boots." Using the toe of one against the heel of the other, I kick my favorite pair of Justins off and let them drop to the muddy bottom. Floating down along the bank, where there are fewer currents and eddies, I become aware of what I had just done. I jumped from a two-story high window into the Mississippi River, following a mysterious woman, after being threatened with certain death by a goon with a switchblade knife. Oh, and I learned about the Cotillard treasure. We dog paddled down the river for a few more minutes before Mariah points at the bank, saying, "We go out." I swim toward the bank a little faster, reach it, crawl out onto a muddy beach, turn around and reach back to pull her out of the water to sit next to me in the mud. Everything is quiet, and it seems neither of us wants to disturb the quiet with any kind of conversation. One of my boots floats by upside down and too far out for me to grab. We are both soaked. My leather jacket is dripping and draining water from the pockets. Although the night is warm, there is a slight breeze, and Mariah wraps her arms around herself with a shiver. I take off my jacket, wringing out as much of the muddy water as I can, and drape it over her shoulders, hoping it will help. We sit quietly for a few minutes. The thought pops into my head. I wonder if that counted against my 7 visits from death. Looking at Mariah, I cheerfully remark, "Well, that was different. What's next?" We go. She stands up, motioning for me to stand up with her. "We need to get more warm." I smile and wonder how those Christian brothers who taught her the same poetry they did me and insisted that we speak proper English, dealt with her colloquialisms. She takes my hand and we stumble away from the river. I assume she knows where she's going, walking us toward, in the little light there is ahead, what looks like a field of monuments. Chapter 30, The Cemetery. And here we have a picture of St. Louis Cemetery, New Orleans, in the book. Sort of a postcard.
Mm-hmm.
As we draw closer, I realize that what I thought were monuments are actually grave markers. She is taking us into a cemetery. On the way there, she explains that people in Louisiana are buried above ground rather than the more common below ground because the ground is so wet and the water table is too high. Much of New Orleans is below sea level. Lines from Thanatopsis, which means a view of death in Greek, the poem I had memorized for my English class presentation, run through my head now. Unable to make it stop swirling through my thoughts, I quietly speak the words aloud. Yet not to thine eternal resting place shalt thou retire alone, nor couldst thou wish couch more magnificent. Thou shalt lie down with patriarchs of the infant world, with kings, the powerful of the earth, the wise, the good, fair forms, and hoary seers of ages past, all in one mighty sepulchre. The time, the place, the shoeless and bootless situation in which we find ourselves almost demands it. Mariah doesn't interrupt. She only listens as we walk. The further we move toward the center of the cemetery, the larger the monuments grow until eventually becoming rows of marble mausoleums with names of New Orleans aristocracy chiseled into them. When we arrive at one about chest high, Mariah takes my hand and places my palm against the mausoleum. Warm, she says. Then she points and says, up. I interlace my fingers and lean over so she can step her bare foot into my hands, and I boost her up to the flat top of the mausoleum. I follow her. She crawls to the far end of the mausoleum, lays down on her side, and puts her arm under her head to cushion it from the hard but warm stone. I do the same, so we end up facing one another. After a few moments of quiet, she checks in with me. You are okay? I am. And you? She wriggles closer to me, putting her free hand on my neck. Oui. While we rest quietly together, I have several minutes to think about the night from the point at which I had fallen over with my bike on top of me to now, where this beautiful young woman wearing my jacket is laying next to me. I wonder, how the hell am I ever going to top this? Mariah opens her eyes, gives me a quick kiss, and pushes my shoulder, causing me to roll onto my back. She waves her hand over my waist, indicating that she wants me to move further away from the edge of the mausoleum and more toward the center. Once I scoot over, she runs her hands down my body from my chest to my waist, unbuckles my belt, and unbuttons the front of my jeans. I lift my head, watching and wondering. A few moments later, she straddles me. I prop myself up on my elbows. Mariah. She pushes me back down, smiles, and holds her finger to her lips in the universal gesture for be quiet. She pushes down my underwear and slips her warm, smooth hand around me. My heart and breath quicken with excitement. Mariah slides her body down over mine, delightfully joining us. We make love on top of the mausoleum, expanding outside the constraints of our lives, making our own choices, and reveling in the freedom of that timeless moment. Relaxing into exhaustion, she slides off to my side and assists in restoring my clothes to normal. Mariah lays down beside me, her head on my chest. Wrapped in each other's arms and covered by my jacket, we talk in whispers for a while. Then she drifts off to sleep. I remain awake a little while longer, staring up at the sky. It's not the starry sky of New Mexico where Mike used to live. It's the cloudy sky over New Orleans, warmed by the glow of the city below, where Miguel is learning to live, enchanted by the woman laying next to him. I finish the verse from Thanatopsis in a whisper. The hills, rock-ribbed and ancient as the sun, the vales stretching in pensive quietness between. The venerable woods, rivers that move in majesty, and the complaining brooks that make the meadows green, and poured round all, old ocean's gray and melancholy waste, are but the solemn decorations all of the great tomb of man. And soon after fall asleep. Well, seems the diving into the river and getting out on the other side is not only what kind of getting away from the bad guys, but it was also kind of a coming of age, now I am a man, kind of a led into this whole romantic interlude between Miguel and Mariah. In the cemetery was apropos as the place of death of boyhood, I think, and then falling asleep to the old life and then waking up to a new life, I think. There's a lot going on there.
Yeah, well, to say the least.
The fact that it was all true, and we just took it from what really happened, just kind of like, oh, wow, we didn't even have to figure out all this, metaphor. And
well, there is the last, when I think about it, the last stanza of Thanatopsis is kind of a metaphor for it. So live that when thy summons comes to join that mysterious realm, thou go not like a quarry slave at night, scourged to his dungeon, but sustained and soothed by an unfalterable trust. Approach thy grave like one who wraps the drapery of his couch about him and lies down to pleasant dreams. And it strikes me that this was a synonym, a metaphor for that part, that moment, that period in my life. Like it was different. It was the acceptance thereof and the willingness to allow it to happen without being afraid, without imagining the worst, just allowing it to happen. I think that made it memorable. I mean, the entire night has elements of memorability, but that sequence of events in those two chapters is what makes this all so memorable, you know, in a good and positive way, life-changing in a way. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, and it's kind of interesting to find, you know, these different acts in our stories and in our lives. I was thinking about that today. I was like, you know, I'm kind of entering into act three in my life, and how would I split them up? Would I split them up as living in Arizona, living in New Mexico, living in South Carolina as act one, two, three, or act one is, you know, when I was single, and act two when I was married, and act three when I was single again. And, you know, how am I splitting it up? And, you know, just kind of was thinking about that. And in this story, you know, act one is Miguel is Mike, and he's unhappy and he's
rebellious,
dissatisfied. Yeah. And he's, you know, I'm going to do something about it. And then act two is him on this journey and finally arriving at his destination, which is Mardi Gras. And then act three is the whole, relationship with Mariah and the running away from Jean-Luc and, you know, having this experience with Mariah. And then of course carrying on to his trip back home,
the return,
and everything.
Yeah.
So I think every story and every lifetime could be, you know, mm-hmm. you can
so
measure it out.
If we look at it from the Joseph Campbell, the hero story perspective, the first segment is the present. And so it's act one, the present. That's where we were in high school until the moment he decides to leave the boarding school. Act two is actually divided into two sections, the climb up and the roll down, right, to some sense of, I think this is a stable moment. And then act three is the return with the boom. And so I think we're at the end of act two here as he starts the return. And he starts wondering, of course, is this the end of an adventure? when in reality he realizes later on that this was the beginning of a lifelong adventure, you know. And then experiences the regret of not having, you know, exchanged phone numbers or addresses with all these people that he had met along the way. It was just part of that. And you know, to the best of my knowledge, no hero's journey focuses as on, well, let's exchange contact information so I can get back in touch with you. It's not even mentioned in it. It's like, you're here, you're that archetype, you know, a supporter or not. But there's no, I don't want to lose this. I want to be able to contact you when this is all done. And that was kind of what had happened. There were lots of people that I met along the way, Lisette, for example, that you kind of wish, like, shouldn't you have gone back there and re-engaged with her perhaps when you got back from Vietnam, you know?
Yeah.
So that she had something.
I don't think it's like you can't go home.
You can't go ahead.
You don't want to meet your heroes. You know, there's certain things that it ruins it when you go back. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't go back and revisit those things because it ruins it. You were at the right place at the right time of your life to experience that moment. But if you were older in a different place in your life to try to go back to that moment or that person, it would be ruined. It wouldn't be the same. So you can't replicate it. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's not going to happen again. You can't repeat history like that.
Right. Yeah.
So yeah.
That's right. And that's true of almost every situation that I've ever been in. I can describe to you, including conversations that I had with people that I met in my business travels. I'll call it that for now, business travels. And it was rare that we got in touch with one another, even sometimes, you know, meeting by accident in a hotel in Washington or once San Francisco. And you're both surprised at the fact and express regret at not having stayed in touch. When you realize that there shouldn't be any regret because you didn't do anything to stay in touch. You know, it was just the nature of that particular beast. So I think what you say is true. I think that's an accurate representation of what we do. I think in order to stay in touch, they have to be people that you are in touch with, whether or not you're near them. Mm-hmm. You know, your children, my children, you and me, the people that we had over last weekend, you know, mm-hmm. those are people that are, regardless of the situation.
I think that's the whole thing of Casablanca, right? Of all the gin joints in all the world, she had to walk into mine. Mm-hmm. But we'll always have Paris. Well, they had those memories together of Paris. You can't take that away. Mm-hmm. You can't change those memories. That was good. You can't redo those.
Right. You can't bring them back.
Can't have it again.
Right.
You know, and they couldn't. They couldn't make it happen again. And that was what the movie was about. You know, it wasn't going to happen again.
I can think of four or five examples where there were situations in which I thought I had developed this wonderful relationship with a person. We were somehow separated. A woman I asked to marry me, my first fiance. Mm. And the plan was to get married after college. And somewhere during college, she fell in love with an anti-war protester that committed crimes that ended up having to run to Canada. Mm-hmm. And she went off with him, didn't finish her school until later. And then one time in Santa Fe, I had come to visit and I ran into her at Fiesta. And it was just like, I wanted it to be a little bit better, but they're just, you know, you can't bring it back.
You cannot go back on that path. Once you've gone off in that direction, on that path, path, you cannot go back and take that path again.
On the other
it's
hand,
not there anymore.
I think we've all heard stories about somebody recovering from one of those where they met their long lost, in love interest.
Yeah.
And they come back together over some circumstance that brings them back together. You know, he has to return home to go to his father's death, and she's working in the general store or something like that. There's love novels, mm-hmm. you know, what are the, romantic novels mm-hmm. that are written based on that.
Yeah.
So it can happen in novels. It's just that you have to imagine it. You can't, right. you know, if I were to write a book now, well, if I were to write a book now about the post aftermath, it would be in a period after I come back from Vietnam, and I'm in Texas anyway because I was assigned to Fort Hood, you know, south of where is Fort Hood? It's by Waco, Florence, Texas, and that would have been a good time to go revisit all of that, see if you could find Lisette, maybe go into New Orleans and see. The problem was at that point I had a wife, a loving wife,
a different person,
and two babies, and you're like I'm not that person anymore.
That's right.
As a matter of fact, I'm probably a completely different person because I've had 2 years and, you know, nearly 5 years in the service and two of those in a combat zone.
Yeah.
So, yeah, because you do change enough so that the context that you give it is that was then, mm-hmm. this is now, and only in romance novels.
Yeah.
Does the follow-up situation work out?
I remember when, so when David Tennant played the Doctor in Doctor Who, I was the 10th Doctor, and they were going to be transitioning to a new Doctor, number 11, and there was all these loose ends, and they decided to go ahead and let him finish up all these loose ends and to give the audience this completion, this feeling of completion, and it was... You know, there was this feeling of, oh, good, he's going back and he's finishing all these, tying up all these loose ends. And it felt good, but at the same time, it also felt schmaltzy. Yeah. There was a lot of tears, but it was like, it's a little too much tears. It was a little overdone. And it was like, yeah, that wouldn't happen in real life.
Yeah.
It's too schmaltzy, you know?
Yeah.
So I think we expect there to be unfinished business in real life.
Because that's how it is. I mean, you're right. Think of it this way. If I were to write up a follow-up to this somehow, after, again, 5 years in the service, 2 years in Vietnam, shipped back to Texas, let's say I'm single, and I go back to visit Lisette just to say, look, I'm back from Vietnam, and I adopt her. She adopts me as her stepson, I guess. I don't know what it is. And then I go to New Orleans, and I mess around New Orleans on the Algiers side, you know, which is now what, 8-9 years later.
Yeah.
And you eventually find out that Mariah has moved back into the, where do you go from that?
Yeah. It's you can't recapture it.
Nope.
So.
That's why you write it down in the book, apparently.
So let's talk about some of the themes and emotions from these two chapters. We have escape and freedom. Jumping out the window and floating down the Mississippi River symbolizes the character's desire for freedom and escape from a threatening situation, Jean-Luc. And this theme can be explored in the terms of the character's motivations and significance of taking such risks for freedom. I think that the entire journey was a risk for freedom for Miguel. Everything he did. And I was, I don't remember where I heard this. I've been listening to some neurologists recently, and they talk about how when we are teenagers, we are so flooded with hormones that it floods our brains and we take more risks when we are teenagers.
Because we think we're invincible
and we're flooded with these hormones, and it tells our brains to do these things. And we do a lot more risky behaviors when we're teenagers than we would as adults. That's why I think these coming of age novels are full of a lot more risk than you would see from, you know, like what we would do nowadays as older people. We're not going to do these kinds of things. We're like, no, I wouldn't do that. I'm smart now. But we also don't have a whole bunch of hormones flooding our brains with these, you know, signals telling us, I got to go do this. You know, let's take these risks and be free and all of this. Plus, we feel pretty free already. You know, we have the freedom to make our own choices at this age. You know, we don't have our parents anymore telling us what to do. We get to make our own choices. So we're like, I can do whatever I want. And no, I don't need to go, you know, riding a motorcycle across the country to feel free anymore. I can just get my truck and drive across town and go to my doctor's visit. You know, I'm pretty free.
No, my first reaction to somebody saying, let's get on a motorcycle right across the United States, you know,
yeah,
is why don't we just check what the tickets for on an airplane are, you
know, right.
And make sure we get a nice hotel.
Yeah.
You know, it's, I'm pretty much past that. I do want to say something. I do have an opinion on the matter of freedom, but I feel like it's not these chapters yet. I think the later chapters, I want to address that because his objective was to experience the freedom of making his own choices on this long motorcycle ride, et cetera, et cetera. And honestly, I can't recall since then, for as long as I rode motorcycles up until the 90s, early 2000s, there has been no trip as long as that one. And the reason is the older you get, the more uncomfortable it gets.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the vibration deadens your hands and you're sore the first night and more sore the next night, et cetera. But I do want to address how this is what he didn't think it would be. He thought by departing and not coming back, he was going to experience freedom.
Mm.
And I think something else happened. But again, I want to address this in a later chapter, not right now.
Oh, well.
You made me think about it.
Yeah. Well, we find out that no matter where you go, there you are.
There you are.
You take yourself with you. So whatever problems you had, you bring them with you because you don't leave yourself behind. Right there.
And the other thing, again, I want to save this for later, is how we learn to define and sometimes redefine the word freedom.
Mm.
And how as we get older and more mature in our thinking, not just older, but more mature in our thinking, we realize that freedom is all in your head.
Mm.
I mean, as long as you're not in prison, right? But, well, I suppose even in prison, you could, you know, freedom is in your head.
Yeah.
But that's one of the lessons that comes with age. And maybe the benefit of what his experience was here was that he had an opportunity to learn that earlier in life than most people, right? You don't start experiencing that until you have that first sense of freedom, you know, sometimes in high school, sometimes in college, mostly after college, where you go like, I'm taking the next year off or whatever, and I can do that. And it's your sense of freedom. And then you realize, no, that's my definition of freedom for that point in my life.
Mm-hmm.
I want to talk about that in later chapters.
Well, of course, we have youthful passion and exploration. We have Miguel, and he's like, hey, that was fun. That's what's next. And he just following Mariah wherever she goes. You know, we went in the river and now we're wet. What are we going to do now? We can't just sit here on the bank of the Mississippi and, you know, we're wet and we're cold. So let's do something. And so they go walking into the cemetery and let's get warm and lay here and then, well, we're not doing anything else. Let's have some fun. Okay, yeah, let's do that.
Wasn't he the lucky guy?
Oh, yeah. So that was interesting. Youthful passion, innocence of youth.
When we published the book to Amazon, I think we qualified. We had a little asterisk that said a couple of mature segments, you know, be careful about giving it to your own. Although I think kids today, they'd be okay with it.
Yeah. We try not to be graphic about that, whole thing.
Yeah.
And it did actually happen.
And I think we did a good job of not being graphic.
Yeah.
Could have been very graphic if we'd wanted it.
Well, yeah. And we had to think, you know, you might give your grandkids might read this.
Yeah.
So they might get grossed out. Oh, Grandpa, yuck.
Ew, you were only 15?
Yeah.
I was going to send a bunch of copies to Ryan and say, see if you can put this in your next book club book.
Yeah.
Although they do novels that are not quite, they're someplace between romance mm-hmm. and women's growth, you know, novels. But they're doing one a month, which is really like she's read 12 books in the last year, which is more books than I think her other sisters have mm-hmm. read, you know. So it's working for her.
It'd be a good book club book. So, you know, and it doesn't take that long to read. So it's really good for a book club book. So.
And I think there's much discussion because, you know, if the group is old enough, they all have sons that may or may not be teenagers. And it's a good way, like, boy, do I want my son even thinking like this?
Yeah. You know? Yeah. So. Well, again, like I said, you could discuss about why do teenagers take so many risks? Part of it is the hormones that, you know, affect their brains. And it's true. And, you know, neurologically, their brains are being flooded with hormones and they do take more risks. Again, we have nature and symbolism, Mississippi River, cemetery, is a backdrop for the character's journey. They're getting away from the danger. They're going to a cemetery. It's a little bit spooky, but kind of a life and death kind of a thing. You know,
the whole, you know, we have the poem, William Cullen Bryant's poem, Thanatopsis, mm-hmm. strung throughout this. And I felt like it was appropriate, not only because I actually did memorize it in order to do that presentation in Brother Thomas's, or what did we call him? Brother, we didn't call him Thomas. I don't remember.
So what did we call him? It's in the first chapter. Anyway, Terrence, we call
Brother
him Terrence.
it is, if you read the poem, it's prose. It's written, it's not written right. in a poetic way. It's a poetic prose, but it's two pages of a book and it's long. And it basically is a reading of someone who has written down how to accept death, the idea of death, without any fear whatsoever. And like I said, including that last stanza, you know, wrap the draperies of your couch about you, lie down to pleasant dreams. And so a lot of what goes on in that poem is throughout this, it's an adventure and an acceptance and a willingness to look at things in a different way. Death is not anything to be feared. Adventure is not anything to be feared. It is to be tried and accepted and form a willingness to make it part of your life. Now, I know it sounds silly to say that death is, you make death a part of your life, but once you do that, life gets so much easier and, you know, and less worrisome. Mm-hmm. I had a wonderful conversation with my cardiologist today, and she said, I looked at your EKG, you're doing great.
Yeah.
And I said, oh, I was wondering if you're going to tell me that I got another year or something like that. And she said, from what I can tell here, you've got several years, you know. Mm-hmm. And it came up after they always ask, what are you up to? What's going on in your life? They want to know psychologically. And I said, oh, I'm in an exciting time in my life. And she said, oh, really? What? And I told her, you know, mm-hmm. About our South Carolina adventure. And she said, you're going to have lots of years with those grandkids. Like, and that was my cardiologist. And we're like, okay, I'm good with that. She said she was going to miss me because I'm a good patient. Yeah. It was a good conversation. It was a great conversation. It was very, reinforcing of the things, you know, mm-hmm. that you do with your health where you're working out, you know. Yeah, what are you doing? What are you doing to exercise? And I told him, I'm trying for 7,000 steps a day. Mm-hmm. And she said, I have guys that don't get around except from the couch to the kitchen and back. You know?
Yeah.
But it was a really good conversation. It was invigorating in the sense that I felt like, you know, okay, we're doing the right thing here at this time in my life, and it's not going to be debilitating. It's not going to be make my life worse. It's going to make my life better. And she reinforced that with the conversation we had. So.
Yeah, I was listening to a podcast today, and one guy had a major issue, a stroke, where he had died for a moment and come back. And the other guy asked him, you know, how are you feeling about death now? Are you afraid to die? And he's like, no. He's like, he had talked about it with his brother-in-law, who is a shaman. And he said, think of all that you had to give up to come to this planet. You know, uh-huh. you had, you know, you were unlimited. You had all this power, and you had to fit yourself into this sausage casing, basically, to come to this planet. And so to die is to go back to the, you know, what you had to give up to come here. He's like, so I'm good with it going, you know, getting to, and I just thought about, you know, how we look at death, as the living on this earth, how we look at death as a bad thing.
The end of something rather than the beginning.
Right. And how maybe we have it backwards, because we're the living get to write the story of, oh, death is bad because we're left behind. When people die, they leave us. The dead aren't the ones writing the story.
So I always think about how fortunate we are to have existed during this period of time, although this period of time is not long in comparison to the length of the universe. And I don't know whether you've been following your Instagram, but there was a series of Instagram posts made by various science-oriented locations about this trip that NASA made to an asteroid. They collected some material and they flew back. It was a 7-year event. They came back and it found all kinds of, but they had a container of things that it collected. The most prominent two things that they collected were carbon and water, which are effectively the building blocks of life. When you have carbon and you have water, you have everything you need over time to start forming one-celled amoebas and, you know, that kind of thing. So their hypothesis is that a long, long, long time ago, some of these asteroids hit Earth, deposited the carbon, deposited the water, and that was the beginning of our life. And we've evolved from that carbon and water to what you and I are here having this conversation about life and death. And it reminds me how fortunate we are in the grand context of luck. Right, because that's what it is. We're here because it was absolute luck. Everything that got us to this point, from carbon and water to where we are sitting across from each other, enabling a thoughtful conversation, is pure luck.
Or design.
Well, don't get me started.
Design that we're unaware of.
You can call it evolutionary design. I'll accept evolutionary design. Mm-hmm. But part of it was luck. The fact that some asteroid landed on a planet.
I mean, it's like when we were talking about the...
Do me a favor, move back so I can straighten this out and get you.
We were talking about the Ring of Fire and the eclipse. And you're like, isn't it marvelous and amazing how, you know, the universe. And I was like, well, yeah, the universe taught us math. Mm-hmm. We wouldn't have math if we hadn't figured out things about the universe. That's where math came from. And I'm like, okay, so...
Well, the what every time we have an eclipse, it brings to mind for me the serendipitousness of the fact that the sun is 400 times bigger than the moon, and the moon is 400 times closer to us than the sun, and that's what makes it a perfect eclipse. I don't know if it's 400 or 4,000, but the fact that there's that ratio. But a fortune, you know, pure luck of the ratio of the size and distance of the moon in comparison to the size and distance of the sun that creates an absolutely perfect eclipse. Mm-hmm. And I don't feel like that's design. I think that's the nature of the universe. Like, it's got a lot of things. Well, it's got a lot of things going on. That just happens to be one of trillions. billions and billions of stones.
Yes, math. Intimacy and vulnerability. The moment where Miguel and Mariah come together intimately emphasizes themes of trust, vulnerability, and the emotional connection between characters. It's an opportunity to discuss the importance of consent, communication, and emotional maturity in relationships. Consent. We did talk about this when we were writing it.
Yeah.
Because I was like, oh, wait, you're like, Mariah, are you saying stop? What's going on there?
I certainly didn't. If I had any concerns enough to have expressed, I chose not to express them. I wanted to experience what was about to happen, but I think what was fortunate is that I didn't have a lot of time to think about it. It happened so quickly in the context of what we were talking. It took as long as it took to write that segment of how it got started, right? So I think if I had had time to think about it, I might have worried about consent and age differences and things like that. But I didn't. I didn't allow myself the biblical guilt that would be associated with saying, no, I can't do this. I'm a good Catholic boy, which is probably what I should have done, but I didn't. So more things. And here's something that you should, there is no member of my family who ever knew that took place because I didn't tell them. They didn't know much about the story generally, but I didn't tell them. I didn't make it a point to tell them. And they'd all passed away before the book was written. Mm-hmm. So nobody ever said, so what happened? Yeah, and my mother, you know, was never interested. I mean, she never indicated any interest. There was no, so what happened? Tell us all about it.
I mean, nobody'd want to know anyway.
Right. Well, I mean, the whole trip for her, it was just, oh, you messed up again and you ruined my life. And
it wasn't about you. It was about her.
Yeah, it was mostly about her. So I never had a chance to tell her anything that happened. The Christian brothers, of course, grilled me to no end in a good way. I don't want to imply that it was in a bad way. They wanted to know what had happened. But they wanted to know, you know, like, how did you like, they didn't quite say this. So how did you find Mardi Gras? Mm-hmm. Remember, it's a religious celebration. That was a bunch of drunk people hanging on each other and throwing beads and showing tits. That wasn't very religious, but okay, we'll call it a religious. But they wanted to know. And of course, all the boys in the boarding school wanted to know what was going on. I refined the story over the next several weeks as I got better and better at telling it. So, but it was fun. But that was kind of, I literally do not remember any member of my family ever saying to me, so how was that little adventure to New Orleans? Mm-hmm. Ever. I guess I shouldn't have expected it, you know.
But you felt it was a good experience.
I there is nothing about that, about what's in this book that I regret. Nothing. I mean, if there's something that I should regret, I'm sure you would have told me when we were writing the book.
No.
No, I mean, think about it. What is there to regret about it?
No.
No, yeah, that's kind of how I was. So, and that's how I took it through the rest of my life. And I, you know, I sent the book to my kids. I don't think any of them have read it because it's never come up in conversation. But it was the first book we had done together.
My family's read it.
Have they?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, yeah, your family's probably read it more than mine. That's what I'm thinking. But we've never talked about it. There's been no sitting down at the table and said, what was this whole Mardi Gras thing with you, Dad? And you know how they are. They're curious about anything that I'm doing, you know, generally speaking. But it was never much. It's never been much of a conversation in my family.
Nobody asked if that was your first time or anything, though.
No.
Miguel reciting the poem Thanatopsis reflects on themes of mortality, the interconnectedness of life and death, and finding solace in nature. Delving into the symbolism and meaning of this poem and its relevance to the story can enhance the literary analysis. We picked this poem because you actually were reciting it in the opening scene of the book, which was real. And so we decided to pull it apart and carry it through. And it fit with the different scenes, especially because you were in a cemetery.
Well, first of all, it was written by a famous poet who became more famous after he died than when he was alive, William Cullen Bryant, and it was written in the 1800s. And so a lot of the verbiage is archaic, an archaic perspective of death based on that period of time. But what he was trying to do in the poem was convince perhaps himself that death was nothing to be afraid of, that it is part of nature's nature's plan for you, and that you're it's just another bit of nature. And throughout the poem, from the beginning to the end, it's always compared to nature. If you pull it apart, if you were to ask Chat GPT, what is the meaning of the poem Thanatopsis? It would be the relationship between humans and the context of nature, and how that all results in the same place, because there are several times where he's talking about the trees die and plants die and, you know,
circle of life
kind of thing. Yeah.
Well, I feel like there's a connectedness between almost dying and then wanting to have sex. And it seems like they show that in a lot of war movies or
the action adventure flicks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And even in MASH or WTF, the movie, where people experience a fear of that they're going to die, and then they have sex and it's somehow connected, so that almost dying, falling into the river, nearly, you know, drowning, and then having sex, it just seemed like a natural progression of that's what people do.
I think it revolves to it refers to the gratefulness of having survived the adventure, and what you would do. Like some people I know from experience, having survived, their first reaction is, let's get drunk and have a party. Other people, having survived, become introspective and want to be alone so they can just think about what they want. Other people find the solace of having survived whatever the event or adventure was in the arms of someone else that they may or may not care about. You know, we hadn't developed any serious kind of relationship. We had known each other for a night. And so there was what we were experiencing as children, I suppose you could have called it love, but it seemed like really appropriate. I mean, I didn't have as I said, and I probably shouldn't say this out loud, but I didn't have a problem with it.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going like, okay, this is going to happen. It was accepting in the way like, this is going to happen, and I don't think I want to stop it, as opposed to, ooh, this is going to happen, and no, I'm a good Catholic boy. Slow down there, big girl.
Well, it seems more like a people who almost die, they don't, then they have sex to celebrate life or procreate. It's this primal need. This, you know, you don't think about it. It's not a thinking thing.
Oh, that's interesting. It's evolutionary.
It's a limbic system. Yeah, it's a primal brain thing that you don't think about. You felt, I'm going to die, and then you didn't die. So then your primal brain takes over and you get into procreation mode. It's just,
I like that. I think that's perfectly rational that you experience some you have a near-death experience and you come back from it and you're with someone and your reaction is, wow, I could die at any time. Let's make babies.
Yeah.
So that we can not let's make babies so that we can make babies, but that's how close we are to dying every day. Let's make sure, evolutionarily speaking, we make it. And of course, you're hoping at the same time that, geez, I hope that doesn't result in a.
Right. It's not a thinking thing.
Yeah.
It's
a response.
It's just a primal thing.
Yeah. Primal response.
Yeah. So I think it's a natural progress. It's a natural thing at that point.
And hopefully you're with someone who's okay with it.
Yeah. Well, and I know some of the things that we've written and that's where it went. Killing Hope, when we wrote that.
Yeah.
That's where it went.
Right.
They almost died and then they
made love.
Didn't. And then they made love. Mm-hmm. So because that's the progression, that's what happens in war zones.
Well, it happens in war zones in books and movies.
Yeah.
The question is, does it happen in real life?
Well, obviously.
Well, I mean, obviously here, that's one example.
I mean, that's where it comes from.
You think that's it?
Because it comes from real life.
Yeah, that's true. It
comes from these real life stories.
So make sure that when you plan your next adventure and you plan for surviving it, that you also plan who you're going to be with. Make sure they're okay with your post-adventure experience.
Yeah, yeah. And consent.
Consent. I mean, it's titled, you know? I think Shelley titled one of the themes of this a consent. What did you call it?
Yeah, it was
intimacy, vulnerability.
Yeah, vulnerability, yeah. Consent. So think about that. Resilience and hope. So I think as they're talking and falling asleep, and then he's reciting Thanatopsis again at the very end, there's hope. And he's saying that, you know, this is not Mike looking up at the starry sky of New Mexico. This is Miguel looking up at the sky of New Orleans, and you know, he's a new person, and you know, he feels good about life.
Well, and also at that moment, as he's looking up at the clouds above, the New Orleans lit clouds above, as Miguel, mm-hmm. he has no sense that this adventure is ever going to end.
Yeah.
Right. Your expectation is that you dry off and that you go to the bayou and hide from Jean-Luc for a while until you decide where you're going to go to find the treasure. So all this is running through his head as well. Not that there was a treasure, but that's what would have happened. As we'll see in the next chapter, it just doesn't turn out that way for him.
And I think that we currently have that same kind of hope. You know, we have come away from this last summer of
turmoil
and difficult challenges. And, you know, we're entering into Act Three. We're looking forward to selling houses and moving to South Carolina and having a new adventure and, you know, becoming our next selves, whoever that might be, you know, whether that's Miguel or whoever that is.
South Carolina is different in personality from New Mexico.
Yeah.
And as a result, it will have an impact on the people who we become and who we are, because I know where, and I know from experience, after having spent the majority of my life in Virginia, I came back here and I felt like I was completely out of place. It took me a couple of years to get back into being in New Mexico, the land of enchantment, and
slowing down.
Everything slowing down and things not becoming as important. And so I think we're going to go back to experience some of that. I think the difference is when in Virginia, I was raising a family of six. There, I'm not going to be responsible for the family other than to visit it on a regular basis.
With Poppy,
which is a different, you know, it's a different role for me.
Yeah. And for me.
Yeah.
Glamour.
Glamour and Poppy.
Glamour and Poppy.
Are Glamour and Poppy coming over? It's almost time. They haven't seen him for a whole week, Ilsa.
Yeah. Yeah. That'll be fun.
Yeah.
And I'm looking forward to that that new role. You know, not being just the YouTubers and the...
I'm looking forward to sharing all of my, what do you call them, phases with them.
Yeah.
I want them to look through a microscope and see a bunch of little crawly creatures.
And
you know,
I'm looking forward to teaching a whole new crew of kids to read because I love that.
Yeah. Yeah. And they'll like that, just sitting there and listening to you read. So
yeah.
Maybe we can write a couple of children's books.
I love to teach kids to
read. I think
read.
We should it's write fun. A children's book so you can read to them the children's book.
And then Toby and Miguel and Mariah went off into the cemetery holding hands.
No, we can't. That's not a children's book.
The end.
All right, you're over, and well, you're not. All right. Quite an hour. You're hitting, coming up.
Well,
on
we
hour.
Hope that you enjoyed the story of Miguel and Mariah, and there'll be more next week. But I think that's about. Oh, we'll see if Mariah.
That's the end of Act 2.
Yeah.
We're going into Act 3 next
week. We'll see what happens to Miguel from here on out. It's going to be different. So I hope you'll join us for that. And if you would like to share your story of what's going on in your Act 2 or Act 3 of your life, please write to us and let us know what's going on there.
Take your bye-byes.
We'll see you again next week. And thanks for joining us. Thanks for listening to Our Story, Your Story. We hope you enjoyed hearing our stories and those of our guests. We invite you to share your own stories with us by emailing us at stories@agkmedia.studio. And don't forget to subscribe to our podcast so you don't miss any future episodes. Until next time, keep telling your story because your story matters.